On this semi-official last weekday of summertime, how are you feeling economy-wise? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, as I alluded to, the second day of September, the end of a longish week at the end of summer. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Two numbers with which to begin today. Wait, actually three numbers. Here you go. The first one, 151,000. Obviously, the number of people in this economy who found work last month, as you've been hearing all day, 4.9%. The unemployment rate changed in August from a month earlier. Also, five. That is time in minutes of live radio that we're going to take to discuss the 5 days gone by. This week's lucky winners are Lynette Lopez from Business Insider, John Carney from The Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
John, you get to go first today. The jobs number, fine, passable. Give me your gut.
Yeah, it was fine. It came in, you know, lower than people expected, but there's a long history of August coming in lower than the expected number, which makes you wonder why they can't adjust for that and expect lower.
Nah, in the biz, we call this the Goldilocks number.
It's go from there.
It's not
there
too cold. And it means the Fed probably won't raise rates in September. But it was a passable jobs number. It's not a goose egg. Obviously, I've stood on this soapbox on the show.
Wait, are you going to say wages?
Wage growth.
You can't get the wages yet. Don't get the wages. Don't get the wages. Because here's what I want to know. Since you brought it up, the whole Goldilocks thing, right? It seems we go from, yay, this is awesome, for a couple of months. And then we go, oh, yeah, no, it's fine.
Well, don't forget goose egg we had in June, which was like 36,000 jobs. That was bad.
So we had really good numbers for a little while. And now people are saying, look, this is enough to sort of say the economy is doing okay, but it won't pressure the Fed to raise rates. Anybody who wants to vote, who is thinking about not voting to raise rates, now has a pretty good excuse of let's wait and see how this develops. So I think people are pretty happy with that.
But here's my question, and you guys can take turns or flip a coin and see which one answers it. Here we are 7+ years into this recovery, and we're still, oh, yeah, it's fine, you know,
wage
whatever.
Growth.
Okay, now go wage with wage growth. Go ahead. Go
wage
ahead.
Growth. You know, this is what Janet Yellen is watching. She's watching full unemployment. But right
no, full,
there,
full, in, full employment, right? That's what that's basically
full
what
employment.
We have.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Whoops. She's watching full employment. But what if that full employment isn't giving Americans the purchasing power they need to really grow this economy?
And you know, you can see some of that in the kind of jobs that were created. So we lost manufacturing jobs, we lost mining jobs, and we added lower productivity jobs, and that is not great for economic growth.
Yeah, so people are working long weeks. Their wages are meh. Yeah. It's not a good situation.
All right, very quickly, yes or no answer. September rate hike, Lynette?
No.
No.
Johnny, all right, there we go. Moving on. I would like to discuss for a very brief moment one Mr. Timothy Cook and his company Apple, which got spanked by the European Commission this week, a tax bill of $14.5 billion. Mr. Cook says, and I'm quoting him, it's total political crap. Lynette, what is up?
Well, okay, I don't know if it's total political crap, because total political crap fighting over the economic ties between the EU are what led to Brexit. So it's not total political crap. I see this as, you know, the story behind this is that Ireland should not be giving sweetheart deals to specific companies. It can have a countrywide lower tax rate than other countries in Europe, but it cannot give a specific deal to a company, which is what the EU is arguing.
Right, John, there are other companies out there looking at this Apple case going, oh man, they're but for the grace of God, right?
Yeah. This has a lot of people worried, a lot of people on the phones with their lawyers and their investment bankers trying to figure out whether they are also at risk of this. And I think the chances are actually very good. I don't think this is some sort of anti-Apple thing. I think that it's an expansion of the EU power saying, look, we set out some rules about what you're allowed to do with your taxes. We think you broke them here. You're part, you want to, you know, you're part
and
of the
And are you
EU.
Calling that expansion or enforcement?
Right.
Like, let's not throw words around.
Right. So let's flip this on its head for just 1 second and ask whether this possibly is a case that gets whoever's in the White House come springtime and the Congress of the United States and also corporate America, Lynette, lined up behind some idea of corporate tax reform.
I have never even thought about that because, you know, I mean,
that just doesn't
seem plausible.
Yeah,
no.
I think that
the issues going in, if Hillary wins, then we're going to talk about pharmaceuticals. We're going to talk about some of the issues that are bubbling up right now first.
I don't think there's a lot of appetite among the public for cutting
tax reform.
Pardon me for being policy sensible. John Carney from the Wall Street Journal, Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. Have a good weekend, everybody.
You too, Kai.
All right.
Bye,
I'll
Kai.
Talk to you soon. Bye. Traders put summertime in the rearview mirror with a somewhat feeble stab at a Jobs Day rally today. I can't believe I just got abused by my rappers. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A thought by way of setting up this next story. It's entirely possible that chemistry, or, well, maybe it's actually physics, thermodynamics to be precise. Somebody out there tell me which it is. Anyway, it's possible that that is going to be the thing that slows down our digital revolution. Let me explain. Samsung announced a huge and really not good at all recall of its new Galaxy Note 7 phones today because of, and this is a quote, battery cell issues. While Samsung investigates, the company is recalling the 2.5 million phones sold since the Note 7 was introduced back in mid-August. And it's not like lithium-ion batteries haven't had problems before, but might those batteries actually slow the pace of change in this economy? We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to look into it from our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
You don't have to Google this. I can tell you, the pictures out there of the messed up Samsung phones aren't pretty. I'm not sure exploded captures it exactly. Maybe scorched, as if hit by a phaser set to stun. Jeremy Kaplan is editor of DigitalTrends.com, and he says it's embarrassing for the company, sure, but the problem isn't really Samsung's. It's with lithium-ion batteries that power most of our consumer electronics.
Lithium-ion battery technology has been around for decades, and frankly, manufacturers have never really solved the problems with these things, which is why we keep seeing battery-powered scooters that explode, e-cigarettes and cell phones and laptops that occasionally explode.
The explosive potential comes from the lithium itself, an element that's perfect for small devices because it stores a lot of energy in a very small package. But, explains Claire Curry at Bloomberg New Energy Finance,
lithium is very reactive, quite dangerous, and not stable on its own.
So they add other metals to stabilize and cool the reaction, and that's worked well, says Scott Sklar, who teaches sustainable energy at George Washington University.
They've gotten much safer over time. Most of them have not exploded.
Sklar says continued R&D will keep lithium-ion the standard in our devices for a long time to come, though there are promising new battery technologies, too.
We have a lithium air battery, sodium batteries, nickel batteries, carbon supercapacitor batteries. We have thin film nano batteries.
But Sklar says most of these are still many years from being ready to put in our laptops and smartphones. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I want a carbon supercapacitor battery. That's what I want. If you had to pick a healthcare story that's been dominating headlines the past couple of months, high drug prices would be a really good contender. And not just the EpiPen price spike we've been talking about the past week or two. Drugs for malaria, hepatitis C, HIV, all of them have seen sharply rising prices as well. In response, and because politics, today Hillary Clinton announced a plan to go after drug companies that jack up prices on some of those critical drugs. Although, with the American drug market being what it is, it's unclear how much her plan can actually get done. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
At first glance, it may sound like Hillary Clinton's plan today is an attempt to tackle drug prices overall. It's not. Clinton economic policy advisor Mike Shapiro says it's to go after an insidious problem where a subset of drug makers crank up prices on generics just because they can.
So what the plan is trying to do today is to figure out when there is an unjustified price increase and give the government a set of forceful new tools.
New tools like the ability to import drugs or levy fines against companies that raise prices astronomically.
The Clinton plan, so far from where we need to be, that is just not credible.
Harvard economist Amitabh Chandra thinks this particular proposal does more to inspire Clinton's base than tackle the root of the problem. There's enormous public support from the public to let Medicare negotiate prices, 83% according to a recent Kaiser Family Foundation poll. Clinton endorsed the concept last fall. Right now, pharmaceutical companies benefit from the fact that their biggest drug buyer in the market is banned by law from negotiating prices. That buyer? The United States government. Medicare and Medicaid are drug companies' cash cow. Now, if, and it's a big if, the president and Congress allow the government to negotiate with drug companies, it could set a new standard price, a lower price that would extend to the private market too. Chandra says it's a nice theory, but as long as Medicare is required to cover virtually every drug, we won't make progress.
We always say let's get the government involved in the negotiation, but what that misses again and again is that is only going to get us lower prices if government can walk away from things.
Chandra says the dilemma we must face is that if we want lower prices, we can't have it all. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
If you're the type that checks grocery prices closely every time you shop, you already know this. If not, consider this the consumer education segment of this program. Egg prices are near 10-year lows of late, as little as 55 cents a dozen at the wholesale level earlier this summer. Fine for the egg-consuming public, not fine for the egg-producing industry. In recognition of that industry's troubles, the Department of Agriculture is stepping in to buy about $12 million worth of eggs, just like it's buying, as you might have heard, a big chunk of surplus cheese as well, $20 million worth of that. It's all going to go to places like school lunch programs and food banks, part of a program that dates back to the Great Depression. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
Poultry producers were hit hard by the avian flu last year. It cost them about 40 million birds. Erner Berry egg industry analyst Brian Muscajuri says flocks rebounded faster than expected, but he says egg producers and processors are still struggling.
The demand hasn't kept pace. You know, the cart market hasn't been over a dollar since this past Easter. Their dried egg inventories are, at five-year highs.
Muscajuri says exports are down and big food companies have tweaked recipes to use fewer eggs. Now, the USDA will attempt to mop up some of the surplus of eggs and egg products. And it's doing so through the Agriculture Act of 1935, specifically Section 32 of it. Dan Sumner is an ag economist at UC Davis. He says the money for the purchases comes from import tariffs on agricultural commodities.
Sometimes it's used to purchase fruits and vegetables or other commodities that, like eggs, for example, that for which there's no substantial other federal government subsidies.
Some of the other stuff the USDA has recently said it would buy up: orange juice, blueberry products, raisins. Sumner says when the program was devised in the Depression, farmers were wretchedly poor. But he says that's not the case today. And he doubts the government's purchases will make a big difference for egg and dairy producers. It's buying up a small fraction of overall production. Bob Young, chief economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation, agrees.
They tend to not buy a lot of this stuff. We were kind of hoping they would have bought a little bit more.
But Young says the purchase programs probably will give farmers a psychological boost, and the food will get donated to people who may not have gotten it otherwise. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up,
Hollywood traditionally has been thought of as a tourist area, and what we're really seeing it become is more of a neighborhood, which I think is great.
A new series that we're calling At the Corner Of. Today, it's Hollywood and Vine, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 72 points on this Friday, 0.4%, 18,491. The NASDAQ added 22 points, 0.4%, 52.49. The S&P 500 up 9 points, 0.4%, 21.79. For the week that it was, the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P all up about 0.5% or so. Told you about Samsung and the whole battery thing. Investors still liking it, up 0.6% today. Motorola Solutions gained 1.5%. Delta Airlines says that big computer outage last month that caused more than 2,000 flight cancellations cost $100 million in lost revenue. Delta still climbed nearly 1% today. Let me get a little plug in here. My interview with Delta CEO Ed Bastian is on our website, marketplace.org. Bonds, meanwhile, fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.60%. Come on. You can't plug your own thing. Why do it? You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's Friday. Labor Day is upon us. Maybe, depending on where you live, you're going to squeeze out one last big summer barbecue this weekend. If so, we are here to help. Meathead Goldwyn, yes, Meathead, bills himself as the barbecue whisperer. His newest book is called The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. It's good to have you on the program.
My pleasure.
You went all science-y in this book. I mean, it is, in fact, called The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. Whatever happened to just throwing something on a grill and poking it and, you know, having dinner?
You know, I think there's a trend now in the culinary world. We're in a technological age where people want to know how things work, not just give me a recipe and make me do it. You know, Alton Brown and yeah. Cooks Illustrated and The Food Lab by Kenji Lopez-Alt. These are all science-y type books, so I've added mine to the genre.
Talk to me for a minute about tools. What do I need to grill? I mean, you've got a whole section here on, like, infrared thermometers and all of that jazz.
Well, thermometers are absolutely the single most important tool you can use. A digital meat thermometer. You can get a really good one. There's a brand called Thermopop for $30. And they read almost instantly. Those old dial thermometers are not accurate, and they take forever to give you a reading. And there's if you want a steak medium rare, that's 130 to 135 degrees. You can't tell by color. You can't tell by poking it. And food safety is a big issue. A digital food thermometer will make your food taste better and safer. Absolutely the number one most important tool.
What do you have on your back porch, you?
Oh, you don't want to know,
no,
man.
I do.
My porch is going to collapse.
Oh, really?
I've got
All right, so hold on. Here's a better question. What's your go-to?
I really love my Weber kettle. I use it a lot. There's a great new accessory on the market called the Slow and Sear, which you can pop into the Weber kettle. You can buy a Weber kettle for $100, and the Slow and Sear is like $90, and it turns your Weber kettle into a smoker, and you can put it in, pull it out. So it's just a great, versatile, all-around backyard tool.
I have a problem when I grill fish, especially sticking.
No.
A lot of sticking on that grill. Help me out.
Got a trick for you.
All right.
Mayonnaise.
No. Ew. What? Wait.
Yeah. It actually doesn't add much to the flavor at all. Mayonnaise is a mixture
warm,
of
hot
egg and oil.
Are you kidding me? No.
No. Actually, I learned it from a chef at a fish restaurant. It helps the meat release from the grill. And that's the biggest problem with fish is it sticks.
Okay.
But if you give a light coat of mayonnaise to it, it won't flavor it drastically, but it will release easier.
This is a really stupid question. Do I put the mayonnaise on the fish or do I put the mayonnaise on the grill?
On the fish.
All right.
Just slather it all over. Most of it melts off. You really won't notice it. You can season it and it'll just melt away, but it'll help it keep it from sticking because it's mostly oil.
You've been doing this a long time, this whole grilling thing. I mean, it's basically your whole life is basically this grilling thing. How has grilling in America changed in all the time you've been doing this?
There's one really noticeable change. Weber does market research. They're the only ones that have really useful market research that I could find. I've been noticing it, and they've put a number on it. In 2004, 14% of the people who were doing the grilling were female. It's up to 27% now. So, it's always been a guy thing. And my theory is that women let us have that space. It's just like, let's humor him, you know, but they let us have it.
The latest offering from Meathead Goldwyn is called The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling. Meathead, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you again.
Kai, always good talking to you. Thanks for the time.
If you're ready for a recipe and a link to the book, Mayonnaise Thing and All, Ew, we've got it on our website. It's marketplace.org. We're starting a new project today, one that takes infrastructure development and demographics, culture and accessibility and economics and rolls them all into one. It's an every now and then kind of series that we are going to call At the Corner Of. We are at the corner of Hollywood and Vine, and we've come to talk to people.
to find out what's going on literally in the heart of Hollywood. It's arguably the beginning of the entertainment business in this town, but it's also a place that's got a lot going on, right? There's construction, there is development, there is history, there's entertainment, there are social problems, and, of course, tourists. You got 2 minutes?
Yeah, sure.
That's Sam and Elaine. They're in town from Cambridge, England. What were you expecting out of Hollywood?
More glitz and glam.
More glitz and glam. Yeah. So this isn't enough glitz and glam for you?
If we come 20, 30 years ago, it would be completely different and it would be really interesting.
So the really interesting part is that 20 years ago, it was a lot seedier.
Okay.
It was a lot worse.
Probably what we were looking for.
More than 6 million people visit Hollywood every year. The somewhat kitschy stars on the sidewalk are a reminder of Hollywood gone by. Audrey Hepburn, man, look at that. This is quite the strip. Vera Miles, Hal Roach, Jackie Coogan. But new development and the resulting construction are inescapable. Viacom, Netflix, and Fender Guitars are moving into one refurbished complex. Kimpton, Millennium, and Dream Hotels are going to be going up in the next couple of years. We needed some perspective on all of this, so I met up with Adrienne Glick-Kudler. She is the West Coast Features Editor for Curbed. They cover real estate. What's the big issue here right now in Hollywood?
The same issue it is all over Los Angeles, which is that there are several different forces who want to see a lot of change, who want to see a lot of development.
That change has been captured, of course, on the big screen. Cecil B. DeMille filmed the first feature-length film in Hollywood in 1913. He rented a barn on a citrus ranch just down the block from where we're standing, and movies have been a window on the neighborhood ever since.
I think of, Pretty Woman, which was shot in 1990, and, you know, Julia Roberts worked Hollywood Boulevard, and it was seedy, and there were cops, and there were murders, and that was, you know, dramatic, but it might have been the most realistic part of that movie.
Glick-Kudler says the tide began to turn with the Hollywood debut of the Red Line Metro extension in 1999, and the opening of a gigantic mall right next door to the theater where they hold the Academy Awards. Are you going to look for a marker and say, you know what? This is where Hollywood is now a place, and it's robust and functional.
Function is a high bar, I think. Los Angeles is in a housing crisis. It doesn't have enough. It needs a lot more. You know, what we're looking for now is, where is the more affordable housing? Where is the accommodations for locals?
Hollywood traditionally has been thought of as a tourist area, and what we're really seeing it become is more of a neighborhood, which I think is great.
Joseph Mariani works for the Hollywood Property Owners Alliance. 20 years ago, the nonprofit created a couple of business improvement districts. The idea was to convince private developers that Hollywood was a worthwhile bet. And several billion dollars later,
we had around 1,700 residential units here in 2000. We're at about 5,600 units. We have another 3,000 in the pipeline. So on top of that, we've seen a large increase in our office market, about 1.2 million in office space.
Those are all big and impressive numbers, but I want to get back to that neighborhood thing.
Sure.
I mean, if you talk to people out in the Hollywood neighborhood,
right,
they're not huge fans of what's going on here because rents are going up, availability's going down. It's tight.
Yeah, no, I think they're seeing it from, in my own opinion, it's from a myopic lens of just traffic, right? That they're seeing it from the traffic lens that traffic is increasing, and that is true, but there's also a lot of good things that come with turning into a neighborhood. For instance, a lot of the retail mix has changed in Hollywood, whereas before it was primarily T-shirts and, you know, tourist souvenir shops, right? We're starting to see more residential businesses come in. You got Press Juicery, Dunkin' Donuts, and a CVS pharmacy across the street here.
It's kind of gentrification, but with a serious corporate bent.
It is. I mean, it's good and bad, I think, in some sense, but we're also focused on affordable housing as well. So it's not gentrification in the sense of the four-letter word gentrification. It's more gentrification in the sense of making Hollywood better for everybody.
It's going to take years to know whether Hollywood's actually better for everybody, but that is not going to stop the hopeful from rolling the dice. So tell me who you are.
My name is Monopoly.
Monopoly. Monopoly what?
Monopoly, well, it's Janelle, but they call me Monopoly. I'm a music artist. I sing. And
that's
stuff.
Excellent. What kind of music?
R&B, pop, everything.
Janelle just moved to town from Washington, D.C. She is all of 21 years old, takes classes at the Los Angeles Film School down the block.
Hollywood is excellent. I never thought I could, you know, get this far. I never seen palm trees in my life. So they just say, just be patient and, you know, be humble, be honest, be hungry. And that's what I'm driven for.
So is this a Hollywood dream? Is that what you got here?
I would say this is the Hollywood dream. This really is. I love it. I love it.
We did this first installment of At the Corner Of in Hollywood because, well, L.A. is where we are. But there are cities
everywhere having the exact same kinds of troubles balancing development and livability, and we need your help finding them. Hit us up on Facebook. We're Marketplace Business News there, or on Twitter at Marketplace. Tell us what intersection near you we ought to think about going to next. This final note on the way out on this Friday, a final rule in government regulation parlance from the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA is banning the most common ingredients in antibacterial soaps, triclosan and triclocarban, for the chemists among you, if I'm pronouncing them right. Not only is the FDA banning them, by the way, manufacturers have a year to phase them out, but in a statement, the agency said this, quote, "Consumers may think antibacterial washes are more effective at preventing the spread of germs, but," it went on, "we have no scientific evidence that they are any better than plain soap and water," end of quote. I knew that. All right, maybe I didn't know it, but I suspected it anyway. All right, the Dow 72 points higher, 0.3% today. The NASDAQ up 22 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 gained 9, that is 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. All right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.